The following program was made possible by grants from the New Jersey Committee for the Humanities through the National Endowment for the Humanities and the New Jersey Historical Commission.
From 1939 to 41, FDR's New Deal was engaged in an extraordinary enterprise. The Works Projects Administration drafted people from the rolls of the unemployed, gave them jobs as writers, and sent them off to interview immigrant families. This ethnic survey, part of the WPA Writers Project, proceeded to gather a priceless oral history that would resonate with the liberal and idealistic values of the New Deal. Among those values, cultural pluralism, the idea that immigrants were capable of becoming real Americans and could do so without abandoning their traditional culture. For New Dealers, the ethnic survey was adding verses to the song of the forgotten American. In the state of New Jersey, the writers collected the life stories of Poles, Jews, Italians, Irish, Lithuanians, the Dutch, and other groups that came to America in the 19th and early 20th centuries. They also wrote descriptions of places, immigrant institutions, and neighborhoods, which have now vanished from the American landscape. The bathhouse, the ethnic theater, the pushcart block, the Jewish farms of rural New Jersey, the streetcar suburbs. Interestingly, whether these places were in fact wonderful or terrible, they were all remembered fondly. Each of us longs for a sense of place, of home. The ethnic survey allowed members of immigrant families to re-experience their lost places, to go home again. To bring these conversations to life, we've used actors to portray both the immigrants and the WPA writers. Now, part two of America, The Dream of My Life, Lost Places. Newark, New Jersey, 1939. A public bathhouse. Like the baths in ancient Rome, the immigrant bathhouses in American cities address a need: urban public health. During the great waves of migration around the turn of the century, few tenement houses have indoor plumbing. The 1890 census describes Newark as the unhealthiest city in the United States. These were truly health clubs, but they are social institutions as well for a variety of immigrant groups. The Clifton Avenue bathhouse is located in the center of Newark's predominantly Italian First Ward. It serves some of the 2 million Italian immigrants who come to America between 1899 to 1910. After a visit, a WPA field worker writes a brief account.
According to the attendant, there are about 6,000 persons who use this bathhouse weekly. Of this number, the Italians outnumber all others about 2 to 1. But the bathhouse is used by all nationalities and in complete unity and respect for each other. Members of both sexes have access. There are 48 showers for men, 27 for women. Also 16 small tubs for the exclusive use of children under 10 years of age, these being located entirely apart from the adults. A common sight in the bathhouse is to see an entire Italian family, ranging from grandfather to grandchildren, arriving for their baths. Many Italian mothers come daily with their children to bathe, their desire exceeding their actual need, according to the attendant. Each person at the bathhouse will wait his or her turn to enter the shower. And there are times when persons have had to wait as long as an hour or even more. But this has not caused any trouble to the attendants as yet. The many different nationalities always seem to be in a good mood and get along very well with each other. While disorders of any kind are immediately curtailed and offenders are liable to arrest, most people who use the bathhouse have a sense of appreciation for its existence.
In 1940, a field worker for the WPA Ethnic Survey visits the Little Theater in downtown Newark, which features Yiddish talkies. There are dramas, romances, and comedies, many with Jewish American movie stars. About 65,000 Jews live in Newark, but the community is not growing as it had been. Through a series of three laws, the quota system passed during the 1920s, Jewish immigration was held down to a trickle. By 1939, European Jews are trapped by Hitler's armies. But the wholesale slaughter is not yet underway. The moviegoers in Newark's little theater cannot know what is in store for their relatives in the old country.
As I entered the little theater, I was somewhat startled. It was the first time, I recall, in my many visits to the little, that it was so completely occupied. I even experienced some difficulty in finding a seat. Finally, after a perfunctory search, I found one next to a portly, well-dressed gent. Once seated, I looked about me and became interested for a few moments in a swift observation of the people about me. I was surprised to note that not a few among them were comparatively young Jews. At the moment, I ascribed this to the fetching qualities of the title, A Letter to Mother. The story is a simple one. It concerns itself, in the main, with one of the many families living in a remote village of White Russia. It has for a father a man of delicate features and physique, who finds greater joy in the spontaneous composition of tunes than in any attachment to the menial requirements of life. His wife, devoutly in love with him, nurtures this tendency and is the sole support of the family. Thus, the disrespect of the children and the village folk generally is incurred, and the father is off to America. Here he consummates his lyrical career in complete failure. He's not fit for the rigorous life before him. The streets of America are not paved with gold. He becomes a park bum and later a pushcart peddler in the East Side. Despite his penury, however, he manages to accumulate enough money to send for his young son, a boy who is considered to be a musical prodigy as an excellent singer. When the boy embarks for America, his mother weepingly admonishes him to write to his mother. Abrivala de Mamon. At this point in the film, I heard a violent outburst of weeping at my side and discovered to my amazement that it was the portly gentleman. There was weeping all around me, men as well as women. Was this due to the excessive sentimentality on the part of those who wept, or did it strike a familiar chord in their own European past? I do not know. I only know that many handkerchiefs were in evidence at this point and throughout the film, until the reconciliation between mother and son.
There's a neighborhood not without reputation in the annals of the police. By day, the thoroughfare is a noisy center of cheap trade, operated almost exclusively by Hebrews. By night, after its business has been locked away, it is a thoroughly Negro community.
So starts a sketch of Prince Street in Newark, written for the WPA's New Jersey Ethnic Survey in the late 30s. It masquerades a simple description, but its purple prose is vaguely anti-Jewish and racist. But like reporter Jacob Riis's 1890 biased description of the Lower East Side in How the Other Half Lives, it is part of the history of history and worth hearing. The description by a WPA field worker, however distasteful, makes the street come to life. And it tells us something else, that not all the interviews collected in the ethnic survey served the WPA's implicit goal of promoting tolerance among ethnic groups.
Prince Street sells cheap, out of pushcarts, out of open barrels, along the sidewalk and across seamy counters. Lentils, dried peas, and lima beans, mountain nuts, coffee, tea, peanuts are sold out of bins. You can fill your pockets with loose tobacco, pungent and moist, scooped out of glass containers to your order. You can buy a suit of clothes, new or secondhand, from a curbstone peddler. You can purchase headache tablets, suspenders, a hammock, silk petticoats, or a statue of Popeye the Sailor Man or Joe Louis, the brown bomber. Prince Street sells cheap. It will even sell more cheaply if you haggle. It invites you to haggle. To take advantage of its cheapness in Yiddish, German, Ukrainian, Polish, and Russian. It also speaks English. And if that is not enough, It argues its prices and values with the frenzy of elbow, eye, and hand. Pushcarts nudge against the curb, lean over and thrust their merchandise at the passerby. Every weary building has a storefront, and before each one, racks of goods crowd against the knees of shoppers. Beside one pushcart, a shriveled little man, his stringy coat turned up about his ears, shouts endlessly, "All kinds of toys, Chip!" and shifts from one foot to another like a chilly bird. Over the stores, there are rooms. Trade goes on there, too, though the faces are Negroid. Prince Street sells cheap, upstairs as well as down. But for this commerce, there's no display, no clamor. The gaunt merchandise hides upstairs, while its salesman, smiling and winking, picks up customers among the crowds. Race prejudice between Negro and Jew on Prince Street rarely breaks out into the open. It expresses itself with mild battling between the two. The Jews jeer the Negroes in Yiddish, and often the colored man's retort is in the same language. There have been a few Negro converts to Judaism, and the Negro women are just as expert as their Hebrew sisters in haggling with merchants. Although, from the cultural and historic standpoint, the two races are very far apart, they have poverty in common. They fight for the same bargains and go to the same relief stations. Their children play in the same schoolyards and attend the same classes.
I was born in Newark in 1898. The Third Ward at that time was a Jewish and Polish neighborhood. We lived in three rooms, a family of four.
This man was wizened and small. He couldn't have weighed 100 pounds, yet he was equipped with tremendous energy and optimism. He was very friendly. He seemed to be trying hard to josh me.
1940, Newark, New Jersey. A WPA field worker describing a 42-year-old Jewish man who in his younger days was a tough, streetwise kid, the kind Saul Bellow soon was to portray in The Adventures of Augie March.
He is one you feel you could rely on in a pinch. He looks as though he would be pretty tough in a scrap. He is sympathetic and possesses a psychological acumen that is really astonishing. He can measure a man in a flicker.
My father, after a few years of working, took ill, and I was compelled at the age of 10 to go out and sell papers to support the family. I went to school as far as the 8th grade. The Third Ward had no playgrounds, and we used to play ball in the streets. Because of the poverty in the neighborhoods, most of the boys had to earn their living any which way they could find. This toughened them up to the extent that some even went to the extreme of stealing and robbing. Fights on the streets were nothing unusual. Neighborhood gangs were being formed all the time and got together and waged fights over anything at all, just for the fun of it. The homes in the ward were poorly built. Most of them were wooden frames with little or no fire escapes. Some of the boys I played with are today leading citizens of the city. The judge is one of them. The gangs used to go out and steal bicycles and took tires off cars. We used to rob corn on Lyons Avenue, which is all farm area at that time. We used to hire a push cart for 10 cents and then sell it. Some of the boys were sent to reformatories. Some of these became hardened criminals to this day. Some of the boys were the best you could meet for a friend. But if you crossed them or did them dirt, they just as well cut you from ear to ears to look at you. They had a very hard sense of justice. They had a strong social sense, all of them. I was the smallest one of all, and many a time I was pushed through a drugstore transom to lift alcohol, which we sold to make whiskey with. A few of the boys got the electric chair, but none of them were real criminals at heart. It was the poverty. When they got older, they became more friendly to one another in the neighborhood. They became like a big family. The playgrounds came when we were fully grown up. There was no relief at this time, and we were always dressed like bums and starved half the time. The parents never made enough to clothe and feed a family, but what can the people do?
Some of my first impressions of my early youth would offer wide contrast to the present conditions which exist in my place of birth. I was born on South 19th Street, Newark, about 28 years ago.
This young man was a rather tall young man and powerfully built. He spoke in a slow, drawling tone and never seemed to rush about anything. He was polite, but he seemed to affect a disinterested attitude, which I resented, and which I think others are inclined to resent.
1940. A WPA writer is visiting a man from Newark. The man fondly remembers a place of his youth, an empty lot. The interview illustrates that any place, however humble, can anchor an experience and bind emotion to memory.
Yes, it was this lot that held the lore and meaning of my early life. And it was to this lot that most of my early life was dedicated. We had, through the lot, easy access to Grove Street and all the magic of apple orchards and vast chicken farms that then existed in the comparatively farm-like area that was then Irvington. I remember, however, the awful dread I had of being there at night. Once, I remember distinctly, I had to go to a farm across the lot for my mom to get some eggs, which were urgently needed for the completion of a cake. It was twilight, and I knew that by the time I was ready to go back, it would already have been pitch dark in the lot. I was morbidly afraid, and I tried in every way to get out of the assignment, but to no avail. I had to go. And go I did. On the way over, I was calm and defiant. I went to the farmhouse, which was supervised by a gray-haired woman whom I vividly recall to this day. Then I started across that vast track for home. I want you to understand that it was during this time precisely that stories of Jack the Ripper were all the vogue. It was because of the story of this fiend that kindly parents used to keep their kiddies indoors after nightfall, and it was this story with its butchery implications that pounded in my brain as I began to cross the lot. Baby, was I scared. I think I must have matured during that walk. Every gust of wind was Jack snorting in my face and preparing for his brutal attack on my entrails. Every shape, familiar as my own face to me during the day, on this night assumed all the wickedness and frightfulness of the Ripper. I remember that when I got to the last 50 yards or so, I clutched those eggs to my chest and spurted with fury for my house. I must have broken a few records, if not a few eggs, in that last dash. My mother was alarmed when she saw me. My face must have been a fright. I shall never forget that night.
I remember in 1880, when the Tsar Tsarina of all Russia honored the city of Odessa with a visit. The maneuvers of the cavalry, the exhibitions of the schoolchildren, the singing of the Russian hymn by 10,000 people. Oh, these things I'll never forget. But it was not long after this that the Jews in the marketplaces had their stalls shoved over by little boys. And when they protested, the boys were joined by others older than they, who wreaked havoc and destruction for 3 days. In spite of gold and protests from the rich Jews of the city, these pogroms became more frequent. How my father pleaded for us to remain instead of going to America. Could he have had a premonition that his best years were behind him?
With so many Eastern European Jews coming to America, in the 1880s, German Jewish charitable organizations in the United States decide that there should be an alternative to the unwholesome city ghettos. They found a series of agricultural communities in southern New Jersey, Woodbine, Hebron, Carmel, Six Points, and many others.
My brother Grisha was very persistent. We must complete our journey to America. Well, so we did. And after 14 days on the Atlantic Ocean, we arrived in New York on a cold January day in 1885. A farm was bought in Vineland, New Jersey. And my father, who had been a merchant, like his father before him, did not know whether potatoes grew above or below the ground. So this venture proved unsuccessful, and a large amount of money was lost. My brother went to school in Philadelphia. I wasn't particularly adapted to such strenuous work, and my mother certainly would not help, as did the Italian women on the surrounding farms near us. We visited the Jewish colony of Alliance, and we found many men who had been tailors or clerks of my father in Odessa. So we sold the farm in Vineland, and we bought one in Alliance. But my parents were very unhappy here. Once my parents went to Philadelphia and planned to stay a week or so, the season being too early to plant crops. So my brothers and I decided, as a result of a mild spell, to rebuild one wall of the little wooden farmhouse. The new wall did not go up as readily as the old came down. As a result, we would have perished in the blizzard of 1888, but for our nearest neighbors, who dug a tunnel in the snow between the two farmhouses. Their suspicions were aroused when no smoke arose from our chimney. Time went on, and my father still continued to hate the farm and the new world. You see, his youngest son died as a result of an accident on the farm. So he cursed the day he came to America and took his spite out on everyone.
Paterson, New Jersey, about 12 miles east of New York City. By 1890, it has established itself as the center for the manufacture of silk ribbon and broad silk, the Lyon of America, Silk City. A century before, a series of water raceways designed by the French engineer Pierre L'Enfant powered the cotton spinning mills of Paterson. The cotton industry was to fail. But in 1839, the first silk weaving mill opened. The silk industry flourished. It required highly skilled immigrant workers. So they came. First the English, Scots, and French silk weavers. Later Northern Italians, Jews, Syrians, Poles, Germans, Russian, Irish, and the Dutch. The large Dutch population lived on a hillside across the Passaic River in a streetcar suburb of Paterson called Prospect Park.
My grandfather was a respected man back home in Holland. He was the only undertaker in the village. And even if he didn't make much money, they were better off than most other people and considered a better class. Then my grandfather decided, after long conferences with grandmother, to come to the United States. It took over a year before she was ready. And the townsfolk gave them a rousing farewell party with the new village undertaker established in his place. And they departed, full of hope and determination, grandfather, grandmother, and nine children. After a journey of 95 long and dreary days, tossed about by terrific storms and bad weather, they arrived here and came right to Paterson, New Jersey, on top of a hill, which is Prospect Park now. The Hollanders there had formed somewhat of a colony. For them all, it was hard to believe. At first, they were in a different country. There was a grocery store, a butcher, a baker. In short, every kind of business where a housewife could go and buy something she needed for her home. The nearest undertaker was down a hill in Patterson, so my grandfather just put out his shingle, and our Holland neighbors took us right into the fold. That was my grandfather's big break. They had a little farmland in the back. The boys and an older sister and my father, in between jobs, went to work on it and raised all the potatoes we needed, a good supply of vegetables, which were canned in the old-fashioned way. At the passing of the first year, they were all happy and content. The population increased more and more, and so did the business. Three of the boys were learning the business now. They were a big help. The girls started to help grandmother a little now, so things went very smooth. On Sundays, they went to church in the morning, again in the afternoon. After the services, they came together at the back of the church and talked and entertained each other. And in that way, my father met my mother, the eldest daughter of a carpenter. For the first years, they saw each other only on Sundays in the back of the church. Then, when it began to look serious, my mother was invited home. She was accepted in the family circle. They used to go for a walk once in a while with my father's sister as chaperone. Most of their get-togethers were either at my father's home or my mother's. Public amusements were scarce and mostly taboo for religious Hollanders. The church is a Hollander's mainstay, his principal way of coming together and entertainment. Very few people bother with politics. Doesn't interest most of them. They're peace-loving, great, democratic people.
Lost Places, Part 2 of America, the Dream of My Life. You've been listening to descriptions of immigrant life collected by field workers of the WPA Writers Project Ethnic Survey from 1939 to 41. The intention here has not been to romanticize these lost places, rather to reconstruct them for a brief moment to find out more about who we used to be. As geographer Yi Fu Tuan has written, places are images that lend shape to our joys and our ideals. But to the extent that these recollections of place do provoke nostalgia, that too is important. Nostalgia is a return, an instructive emotion. Only through nostalgia can we experience what we have lost, what we long for, what we habitually deny ourselves.
You have been listening to Lost Places, based on interviews of immigrants and their families conducted by the WPA Writers Project Ethnic Survey from 1939 to 41. Lost Places was a co-production of the New Jersey Historical Commission and public radio station WBGO. It was narrated by Eli Wallach. The program is based on the book America, the Dream of My Life by David Stephen Cohen, published by Rutgers University Press, and was made possible by grants from the New Jersey Committee for the Humanities through the National Endowment for the Humanities and the New Jersey Historical Commission. The views expressed in it are not necessarily those of the Historical Commission, WBGO, or the New Jersey Committee for the Humanities. Advisors on the program, John Bodner, Gerald Hirsch, Barbara Kirshenblatt-Gimblett, and Virginia Yance-McLaughlin. Heard on today's broadcast, Deborah Allison, Eleanor Basescu, Ralph Fryer, Sam Gray, William Bogert, Earl Hammond, Jane Hunt, and John Layton. The recording engineer was Leszek Wojcik. Tape editor, John Kalish. Mixing engineer, David Rapkin. Lost Places was directed by Charles Potter. It was written and produced by Marty Goldenson. The executive producer was David Stephen Cohen.